Tonight on Arena, Enola Holmes' Tesla Monsoon and Miss Juneteenth are the movies up for review, and rising stars of opera Anna Brady and Rory Dunn are in session. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And film reviews, as usual, to kick off on a Thursday evening. Quite an eclectic selection for you tonight, in fact. Stranger Things breakout star Millie Bobby Brown brings us Enola Holmes, a feminist reboot of Arthur Conan Doyle's classic characters that you didn't realise you needed, seemingly. Ethan Hawke and Eve Hewson star in Tesla, an unusual biopic of the pioneering inventor. Crazy Rich Asians hunk Henry Golding is in the love story Monsoon, which is set in Vietnam. And we'll hear about Miss Juneteenth, the black beauty pageant causing a stir on the festival circuit. Tara Brady and Daryl Jones are our reviewers on this Thursday evening. And we'll start with Enola Holmes, which is the big one, which will be available on Netflix at the end of the week. Daryl, it's safe to say when it comes to the Holmeses, particularly Sherlock, you are something of an expert. So do tell us, where does Enola fit into the Holmes family?
So Enola is the younger sister of Sherlock Holmes and his brother Mycroft Holmes, she is played by Millie Bobby Brown, as you say, the star known to us as the star of Stranger Things, and Sherlock and Mycroft are played by Henry Cavill and Sam Claflin, and Enola is brought up and educated by her mother Eudoria after the death of her father in a country house isolated from the world, and the plot begins when Eudoria disappears.
Does she, just briefly, does she exist? Does Enola exist in the Arthur Conan Doyle stories?
Not as far as I'm aware. There may be some aside reference somewhere, but not as far as I'm aware.
All right. So what we're talking about here are the Nancy Springer actually wrote the books about this particular character.
Yes.
And let me go to Tara then to get the basic premise here. The disappearance of the mother is where we start, really, isn't it, Tara?
Yes, and then there's a kind of an adventure and a road trip and a mystery to solve, as there always is with the Holmes family. I mean, it's quite interesting because I was slightly nervous about coming into this film because the last time we saw a fictional Holmes sister added into the universe, it was the last episode of the BBC one, which went down very badly with fans of Sherlock, including myself. And also there's this very common trope with young adult fiction translations in particular, you know, where the female characters are invariably feisty, and it's like a brand rather than an attribute. But this one works like really wonderfully well. Enola runs into, she's in search of her mother, and she runs into another runaway from a rather privileged background, the Lord Viscount Tewkesbury, played by newcomer Louis Partridge, and he's very dashing, but you know, she never minds all that. She's busy worrying about the fact that someone is trying to kill him, and his vote may just swing the Reform Act in the House of Lords. So it has this very nice relationship with actual history and with the book that inspired it. And it also has an awful lot of imagination. It has all these lovely little illustrations and lovely little cutaways because Millie Bobby Brown keeps addressing camera and she does so in a much warmer and more winning way than you might imagine.
All right. Well, you mentioned those little cutouts. The mother, when she disappeared, has left all sorts of clues the way a Holmes mother would, I guess. Has left all sorts of clues around the house that Millie Bobby Brown's Enola is going to have to decipher. And she's trying to get in contact with her mother, and here she tries to work out a way of doing that.
To find Mother, the first thing I need to do is leave a cipher in every newspaper she might read. Thank you, my chrysanthemum. Are you blooming? Send Iris, please. Iris means message. Now, how to disguise them? Mother can untangle anything, so I need to make it most devious. I placed it in the personal advertisements column of the Pall Mall Gazette, which my mother seldom missed. Plus the magazine of Modern Womanhood and the Journal of Dress Reform. Two publications I thought might tickle her.
Millie Bobby Brown there in a scene from Enola Holmes. Daryl, listening to that, there is quite definitely the whiff of young adult drama about this.
Yes, there is. As Tara said, you know, what we have here is a very modern heroine, a recognisably modern. And yeah, feisty is a good word here, placed in a period drama. So the part of the appeal of the film lies in this disjunction between Brown herself, who is very much a modern person, and her character, who has very modern sensibilities, and the repressive fin de siècle environment in which she's put, as emblematized by the school for proper ladies that Mycroft, her brother, wants to send her to.
The director here, Harry Bradbeer, has been involved in television projects like Fleabag and Killing Eve, and even the pace and the music underneath in that clip that we just heard, Tara, it has a similar feel to it, albeit obviously in a different era and different period.
Yeah, so he has proven feminist credentials, you'd have to say that. But it's a real rollicking pace. I mean, the entire film, like, rattles along. You're going from scene to scene to scene. And the inventive way that the things are presented allows it actually to kind of keep that pace up. You also get, like, sort of access to her inner thoughts, and you get all sorts of little imaginative flourishes like that. But it allows, I mean, as we know, like, Netflix is... Sometimes the CG can be a little bit less than what we're used to seeing in the cinema, where they spend like $100 million just on CG backdrops. But in this case, it's stylized enough to kind of look like a storybook, so they get away with that, and they have a marvelous supporting cast. So no, it's really great fun.
Was there ever, however, Daryl, a hunkier Sherlock than Henry Cavill?
Yeah, he's completely the wrong shape and size for Sherlock Holmes, and he's not convincing to me at all. Yeah, as I say, he looks all wrong. He looks like one of those knitwear catalogue models, doesn't he? You know, he's just not charismatic enough. And you know, Millie Bobby Brown just blows him off screen whenever they share the screen together.
I got to give some love for Henry Cavill here. I actually thought he was quite good fun, and I thought the casting against type thing worked very well, because it allows Millie Bobby Brown to take centre stage, as it were.
Well, it does allow her that's for sure. But Hunky Holmes is what I'm calling him for the purposes of this particular film. What about the other characters around him? Obviously, we've spoken about Millie Bobby Brown there. Fiona Shaw is in there as a kind of the principal of a finishing school. Sam Claflin, you've mentioned as well, as the more evil brother, Mycroft. What other characters, what actors stood out, or performances stood out for you, Tara?
Frances de la Tour's matriarch was very hard to beat. She was absolutely wonderful. And like everybody else, like Helena Bonham Carter and like Fiona Shaw, you get the sense that everybody on screen is having an absolute ball. Sam Claflin's definitely having fun. And Cavill as well. I thought, just to go back to stand up for Henry Cavill again, but I thought there's this lovely little chuckle that he gives at a certain point, which I don't want to spoil, but I thought it was absolutely marvelous. I really liked that.
Oh, Hunkry Henry Holmes, you're definitely going for him, aren't you? You mentioned Louis Partridge there, who's the young Viscount who goes missing, and the Frances de la Tour character is his grandmother. The estate of Arthur Conan Doyle are none too happy about this, Daryl. Can you see why it might annoy them?
They claim issues of copyright here for one thing, we are being given a Sherlock Holmes who is too emotional. And that we only apparently get an emotional Holmes towards the end of the Conan Doyle stories. And Conan Doyle was still writing the Holmes stories, you know, well into the 1920s. So these are still under some kind of contested copyright. It plays fast and loose with the Conan Doyle canon, but we should be used to that by now.
I guess you're going to stand up for an emotional Henry Cavill now, are you, Tara? As you give me your stars.
I definitely give it 4. I think it's a very, very good all-ages family entertainment.
And what are you saying overall, Daryl?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I so enjoyed this film. Millie Bobby Brown is terrific. And I think only a misanthrope or a sexist wouldn't like this film. So also four from me.
All right. It is 2 hours long. Let us say that. Now, you both seem to have found that rollicking pace didn't bother you. I found the 2 hours was 2 hours, no matter what way you look at it, which seems to be a thing that's happening with a lot of the films that we've been reviewing recently. I don't know whether it's something to do with lockdown and COVID or whether it's just that there are longer films. Tesla is another case in point, starring Ethan Hawke as the titular Nikola Tesla, the Serbian electronic engineer whose work was central to the alternating current, or AC, electrical supply system. So, Tara, you have the task of telling us a little bit about Tesla, the actual real-life character, before we get into what happens in this film.
Tesla is this very fascinating and very romanticized character from science and electrical engineering, as we know, and you mentioned alternating current. But he's the kind of person in history who turns up, and when he turns up at Christopher Nolan's The Prestige, he's played by David Bowie. That's how romanticized he is. So this film doesn't deviate from that view at all. You know, it goes with the sort of classic narrative that here's this Serbian emigrant, and he's the architect of modern electricity, and he dies penniless while his main rival, Thomas Edison, for whom Tesla once worked, is this great and wealthy self-publicist who hires brilliant men like Tesla, like Henry Ford, like William Johnson, into his ranks and gathers up the patents and hoovers up the money. But, you know, this rivalry, to be fair, is handled very imaginatively by the film, because the film has this quite daring narrational device. You have the always impressive Eve Houston playing Anne Morgan within the film, but she's also sort of stepping outside of the film and opening up an anachronistic laptop as a narrator and addressing the camera with such pertinent information as the number of Google search results yielded by the name Nikola Tesla.
Yeah, it is a kind of an interesting mix of right now, today, and right back then as well. Let's have a listen to a clip that features at the tail end of it. You'll hear Eve Houston, that kind of narration that she gives us. But this is a scene where we see Kyle MacLachlan as Edison. He's berating Ethan Hawke's Tesla, and they're eating ice cream at the time. And there's a little bit of pie in the face goes on. That's the splash that you'll kind of hear in the midst of the clip.
Alternating current is a waste of time. Impractical and deadly. There's no future in it. $50,000. You think I owe you $50,000, honestly? Tesla, you don't understand the American sense of humor.
This is pretty surely not how it happened, but what can I tell you?
Eve Houston's voice there at the end, and we also heard Kyle MacLachlan as Edison in the midst of the film Tesla there. And that little clip at the end gives us a sense of what Tara was saying, Daryl. While this is, in some ways, you know, it's the guy who really invented electricity kind of is his story, as against, you know, it's a romanticized version, as against here's the guy that we've all been told in history did all the work on electricity in Edison. But the way they're telling this makes it very different from that standard science trope.
Yeah, this is far from being a kind of straightforward narrative film. It's full of these jarring anachronisms. You know, we've already heard about, you know, Eve Houston consulting Google. There's a point at which Edison is checking his smartphone at the Chicago World Fair. You know, a number of the scenes are played out against backdrops that are either period illustrations of things like Niagara Falls or a restaurant or photographs of the period. And most startlingly of all, there's a film in which Tesla sings a very kind of downbeat karaoke version of Everybody Wants to Rule the World. Yeah. I have to say, it was that was the moment at which I decided I'm going with this film and I like it. I was unsure up until then, but that struck me as so preposterous and so kind of daring that I warmed to it.
All right. I know, Tara, you want to talk about Ethan Hawke's accent in this, but we haven't actually heard him yet. So let's have a very brief clip of Hawke as Tesla.
What is this can?
It's a prototype.
You expect me to invest in a spinning tin can of shoe polish?
I do. That motor. will do the work of the world. It'll set men free.
There you go. That's him trying to sell his idea to investors, and that's part of the story as well. The accent, what did you think about it, Tara? I wasn't sure whether you loved it, hated it, or didn't know what to think about it.
I think all three is the answer to that. I did get on with it. I think it's emblematic of everything that works and doesn't work at the film, because this is a film that's best when it's at its oddest and its weirdest. You know, the scene in which you have Tesla and Anne roller skating around a mansion, and the ice cream fight between Tesla and Edison that we heard earlier, and also, of course, the Tears for Fears, everybody wants to rule the world. And you just kind of wish the film was as committed to that strangeness as Ethan Hawke's accent is. I think it reminded me a lot of Marjane Satrapi's recent Marie Curie biopic, Radioactive, which, you know, because they don't have the big lavish historical budgets to spend on these kind of biopics anymore, it has to kind of live by its wits and be very inventive. But yet, this is definitely at its best when it's just been screwy and metatextual and all of those things.
Yeah, because it's examining the whole idea of the biopic as well. It starts from you, Tara.
Three.
And what are you saying, Daryl?
Just for Ethan Hawke's kind of stone-faced performance throughout, he wandered through the film with a very sour expression on his face. So also three from me.
Three from you. Let's move on then to Monsoon, latest to be a feature film from British director Hong Kao. Movie focuses on a relationship that develops between a British Vietnamese man returning to Saigon, having fled with his family as a child, and an African-American man he meets while there, who has his own particular connection with the country. The director here, Daryl, has spoken about the film being personal, quote, rather than autobiographical, quote. Now, you could get annoyed at that, but would you be stupid to get annoyed, or what does he mean by that?
No, I don't think so. So it's directed by Hong Kao, who is not a British Vietnamese, but a British Cambodian person, director. So it isn't autobiographical, but it's obviously written from experience. You know, he was born in Cambodia. His family fled the Khmer Rouge to Vietnam, and from there came as refugees to England. So apparently the film began life as a two-hander. You know, there were just the two of them. There was Kit and the American Lewis, who was then a white American called Hank. But Hong Kao felt, he says, that this is a story which he says, quote, had been heard before. So the film began to evolve into its current form.
Another Hunky Henry involved here, Henry Golding playing the part of Kit. What's the nature of the relationship that grows here, without giving too much away, I guess, Tara, between Kit and Lewis?
Well, it's a romantic relationship, but there's a couple of complications with it. Primarily, I think that there's this other dimension, because both of them, in some sense, are children of the Vietnam War. Parker Sawyer's character Lewis, his father fought in the war on the other side, and then of course there's that relationship with Kit's parents and the war and why they had to leave and whatnot. So that makes the relationship rather more complicated. But there's also a very strange sense about it, because you know, a real sense of like things having come full circle, because here you have this American expat who's come to Vietnam for its opportunities, and then you have this British Vietnamese man who was born in Cambodia, wandering around not recognizing anything that he can remember from his childhood, from the very little few things that he can remember from his childhood.
So these two men who are in Saigon, or who are in Ho Chi Minh City, and that's where they are at this point in time, is it about their dislocation in this huge, vast culture, Daryl?
There's a bit of that going on, and you know there are certain. It's one of those films where that people stare meaningfully a lot at each other and out over the city from apartment buildings. So there is a lot of the sense of cultural dislocation and disjunction, but also cultural discovery that's going on. You know, it's a film full of wonderful shots of the city, but you know it's also a film of discovery, of self-discovery. Kit, in travelling to and then across Vietnam, finds things out about himself, but also comes to terms with and discovers things about his own place in the world and his family history.
So is it worth this one? This does come in onto the 2 hours that I was being given that I've been giving out about. I think it's about an hour. It's just over the hour and a half, in fact, Tara. Does this one, did it work for you overall?
Well, it's a very graceful, nuanced, like quiet, contemplative film. So if those things don't, you know, if you're expecting car chases, it's not going to work for you. That's one thing to say. It almost sometimes feels almost like an installation film, like something that you might see in a gallery, because it's very much a film about headspace and about wandering around. But I thought it was very impressive. I mean, it does have things to say about that strange sense of dislocation you get from going back to where you're from. And Henry Golding, who shot this actually before Crazy Rich Asians, is very, very impressive and in a very kind of reactive performance where he's bouncing off the other actors around him and also the environment around him.
Yeah, and stars from you then, Tara?
Three and a half.
Now, you mightn't get car chases, but you get a great opening sequence of the traffic in the place. It's extraordinary, that particular opening sequence. What are you saying, Daryl, overall?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, it's a slow, thoughtful, but very intelligent film. So 4 from me.
4 from you. And finally then, you've seen this one, Juneteenth. You might explain Juneteenth and what has been told in this film, first of all, Tara.
Well, Juneteenth, as you know, is a day where the Americans celebrate the end of slavery. And Miss Juneteenth is a very wrong-headed beauty pageant that's been set up to commemorate this. So you have the main character, Turquoise Jones, played by Nicole Baran, is a single mother in Fort Worth, Texas, and she's the former winner of a local Miss Juneteenth pageant. It's a beauty contest. It's a bit like the Rose of Tralee. It's not just supposed to be a beauty contest. Mm. It incorporates etiquette and party pieces and things like that. And if you win, you receive, believe it or not, a full college scholarship. So she's determined that her 15-year-old daughter, Kai, will enter the same pageant, even though the mother's daughter hasn't exactly worked out. And we learn that she's worked in a strip club, and we learn that, you know, things haven't really gone her way since her university scholarship. Then there's an additional complication in that the daughter is absolutely no interest. She wants to practice her dance moves. She's a very skilled dancer, but the mother isn't having any of it and is determined to get in debt and is running around doing everything to sort of pay for money and the dress and all this sort of thing.
Let me just ask you about the director here, Channing Godfrey Peoples, who wrote the movie as well. She's from Fort Worth in Texas, so you can guess that there must be a large personal element to the story. She only had $2 million to work with. Did she manage to make a decent full feature film with such a small budget?
Yeah, she certainly did. And in fact, $2 million is the kind of outside estimate. Like, lower estimates are about 700,000. So she did really well. It looks like a proper film. It's lit beautifully. It's shot beautifully. And there are really, really great performances in it. I think the mother-daughter relationship as well is so complex and so touching that even when there's a lot of interior work, that sort of overwhelms any kind of budgetary constraints. The only thing I would say is that for viewers in this part of the world, there's a lot to unpack when you've got this beauty pageant that's named for the commemoration of the end of slavery that demands you do a music trick and use the right salad fork and perform Maya Angelou's Phenomenal Woman in order to go to university. I mean,
yeah, there's a lot there, right enough. But it does sound as if it's worth it from what you're saying. Stars, Tara?
3.5 out of 5.
3.5 out of 5 for Miss Juneteenth from Tara Brady there. And Tara and Daryl Jones also spoke to us tonight about Monsoon, Tesla and Enola Holmes. Wexford Festival Opera and RTE will be bringing opera to your home this October. Now, due to COVID-19, this year's reimagined festival, which is called Waiting for Shakespeare, the festival in the air, will all be online. We'll be bringing you a preview of the festival over the coming weeks before its opening on October the 11th. But recently, two rising stars of opera, Anna Brady and Rory Dunn, who have won the PwC Wexford Festival Opera 2020 Emerging Young Artist Bursary, came into Studio 8 for an arena session. Anna began by performing the Habanera from Bizet's Carmen, Mairead Hurley on piano. Anna Brady there with the Habanera from Bizet's Carmen, and she was accompanied by Mairead Hurley at the piano. Anna is in studio with me along with Rory Dunn, both of whom are part of this year's Wexford Festival Opera, and indeed both winners of the Emerging Young Artist Bursary. Let's talk about that aria first of all, if we could, Anna. You're a mezzo-soprano.
I'm a mezzo-soprano, yes.
That's the ultimate mezzo-soprano role, really, Carmen, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a dream. It's a joy to sing. And as a role, it's something I'd absolutely adore to do.
Yeah, and so you've been studying at the Royal Conservatory in Scotland. You studied, yes. Was it in the Royal Irish Academy previous to that?
I was. I did my undergrad in the Royal Irish Academy of Music. And then I've just finished, in June, I just finished at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland.
So how many teachers' doors or repetitors' doors did you bang down saying, can I do Carmen? Can I do Carmen? Can I do Carmen?
Yeah, a few. I mean, it sits well in my voice. So when I kind of brought it to my teacher, she was like, let me hear you singing it. And in the initial sing through, it was clear that it was okay. And it's okay to begin working on.
Yeah. And even, you know, for somebody who's a minor fan or only knows a tiny amount of opera, they'll probably recognise that tune mm-hmm. pretty much straight away. How difficult does that make it to sing when it's such a recognisable tune and to bring your own thing, your own performance to it?
Well, I kind of really enjoy that. I see that as a challenge, and I see that as a chance for me to really put my own stamp on it. And I love getting into characters and finding my own way through them. And there are so many different recordings of amazing singers, which is inspiration. But I think, you know, as artists, all we have is our life experience and all we have is our imagination, which is what makes it individual. Yeah. So
who stands out in those big recordings? People often mention Callas in this one, but
I actually really love Alina Garancha.
Right.
I think she does it really
she's
well.
Is she a Russian singer?
Spanish
singer, yeah. Right. Oh, well, yeah. She would have then, I suppose, the right flair for it. Even though it's in French, it has that Spanish story,
absolutely.
Obviously.
Yeah, so I really like her interpretation of it,
So she's the one that you're not emulating, but you kind of hold
yes.
up. Is it? What about for the bass baritone then, Rory? Is there a role that really stands out there?
I think depending on the type of bass baritone and depending on your age as well. So, I mean, there's definitely a few coming down the pipeline, probably not for another 10 or 15 years based on. But I mean, Falstaff for me has always been one that's stood out because I quite enjoy comic roles as a whole. And it's kind of the ultimate comic role.
Which is what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I've had the pleasure of learning that over the entire lockdown, which, kept me sane. Also drove me mad, but kept me sane for most of it.
Yeah, and I suppose the unusual thing with Verdi is, when you think about it, that you're normally talking about tragedies, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's not a lot of laughs in a Verdi opera.
But it's his masterpiece.
Falstaff is different.
Yeah, yeah, it was the last thing he wrote before he died. And it's everything in it. You find new things in it every time you look at it. We had our first music rehearsal there not too long ago, and with a pianist and a coach. And we sat down and they stop every 5 seconds. They go, well, he wrote this because, and it all makes sense. And you're just illuminating different parts of it as you go.
Now, obviously this has happened, as I say, as part of the Wexford Festival Opera, the performance of Falstaff. How far down the road are you with rehearsals and with ideas of how the production might actually feel and look?
Very early on. We haven't started staging yet. We are on the way to staging.
On the way
to staging.
It's
been a lot of music rehearsals and sitting down with the piano, because they want everything quite, I mean, as you want it perfect before you get up on your feet and start moving around with it. We've seen pictures of the design so far, but I mean,
it's still early days.
Costumes are and that sort of thing, but it's all very, very much because everything's so, you have to compress everything over the COVID situation. It's very much just kind of compacting things and getting them done as quick as you can, so you're less contact time with people.
And the plan will be that this will go out in episodic form on RTE.
Absolutely,
and
15-minute episodes, I think, is the plan, which works very well for what Falstaff is, because it's six scenes in total, and each one hits around the 15-minute mark, so we haven't had any cuts.
And you're nodding and talking, because you're obviously part of the production as well.
I am. I'm playing Mistress Quickly, so I'm a funny character as well. She's
definitely one of the funniest roles in
it's
it.
It's amazing.
Well.
Yeah.
It's a very different role from Carmen, Mistress Quickly. Yeah. Just explain where she fits into the plot.
She's kind of integral in terms of she's the go-between from the girls to Falstaff, and she's a busybody. She's a gossip, and she really enjoys it, and she enjoys overacting and riling him up, and she enjoys then telling the girls and. Yeah, she's a very, very funny character.
A twister of knives, I think of her.
She's wonderful.
So that's quite nasty as well. It's rather funny.
Yeah, well, Falstaff's quite a nasty... Well, he's more so a nasty character in the Shakespeare plays, but... I mean, Verdi's one's a bit more jovial, but I mean, it's in the way everyone reacts to him, you can tell that he deserves his comeuppance.
Yeah, he's a bit of a manipulator, there's no doubt about that. Now, you're both winners of the PwC Wexford Festival Opera 2020 Emerging Artist Bursary. What exactly does that mean for you, first of all, Rory?
Yeah, so what exactly does the...
You'll be given some money towards things you want to do.
Towards studying and towards furthering a career in opera, and it's amazing to get chosen to be awarded it out of the people in the factory.
Yeah, because you started life, I think, as an actor.
I did, yes.
When did the change come? When did the moment arrive when you thought, you know what? Yeah, speaking and being in a character is one thing. No, I want to sing in character.
I think it was a gradual thing wherein. So I studied in the Bull Alley Theatre Training Company for 3 years. And as a part of that, you do a musical theatre module where you are in a musical every year. And I'd sang once, I think, when I was in secondary school on a stage thing and had done smaller things. But then once I got into these musicals, I think it kind of took me by surprise that, I can actually do this well enough at the time. And then someone in the orchestra kind of said, you should get your voice trained. And I was struggling to get any auditions as an actor, so I said, well, why not? One more string to the bow.
Well, we can certainly hear in the speaking voice, we can hear the bass baritone is alive and well. For you then, with the studies finished, what will it be a case of masterclasses for you, Anna?
I mean, it's the same thing in terms of putting it towards coachings, putting it towards just furthering the career and development. Yeah, with other kind of artists.
You've both also come out of what we refer to as the Wexford Festival Opera Factory. Mm-hmm. What's involved there, Anna?
Well, it's an intensive 10 days where you're working with incredible artists every day on the main stage and in other parts of the theatre. So performing on the National Opera stage every day was amazing. But the visiting artists we had were just phenomenal. Yeah. The masterclasses we got... so much more than I think we were kind of, you know.
We didn't know some of the people.
We didn't know some of the people.
But the names were coming up. I mean, you had Diego Flores did masterclass. Celine Byrne.
Yeah.
And Dmitry Vidovin, the head of the Bolshoi
Young Artist.
Young Artist Program in Russia. So it's just, I mean, but also Ernesto Palacio.
Oh, yeah. Maestro Ernesto Palacio is one of the most famous tenors. And we got to work with them every day. And
on the stage.
On the main stage.
What kind of feeling is that? I know you're in workshop, you're in rehearsal, whatever is going on, but still, you have to fill that space.
Honestly, for all of us, it was the first bit of performing we did in 6 months. So it was it was emotional. The first time we sang for everyone, it was really emotional. We were all you could see everyone was,
caught me off guard completely.
Caught me off guard, absolutely.
We walked out after singing in my...
bedroom
for about 6 months of Falstaff to get out into the beautiful opera house in Wexford. It's gorgeous, and you get up there, tilt your head up and sing, and the sound just comes back at you, and you're just
phenomenal.
It's a whole body sensation. It's great.
Yeah, a bit more space than the average bedroom.
Yeah. A little bit, definitely mine.
I think anybody's probably, Rory, we're safe to say. You're going to sing the catalogue aria for us, Rory, from Mozart's Don Giovanni. Explain to us who Leporello is and what he's doing here, counting his master's exploits, I guess.
Yeah, so Don Giovanni is kind of this, he's based off the Don Juan character type of this... guy that goes around the world seducing women, and then after he's done so, fleeing. And Leporello is his footman who pretty much cleans up his mess after him. And in this, he's distracting Don Elvira, who the Don has seduced, and she's trying to get after him. And he says, look, don't worry about it. Don't fret too much about it. You're not special. Here's the list of all the women he's done it to. And I think it's in one way, it's him trying to get her to calm down, but another way he hates Don Giovanni, but he wants to be him as well. He's a very complex. Mozart writes these characters that are just brilliant.
Don Giovanni certainly not obeying any travel restrictions. He gets around quite a bit, as we'll hear. Okay, let's have it then. Rory Dunn, accompanied by Maria Hurley, and the catalogue aria from Mozart's Don Giovanni.
Mein Spanier son ja mille tre, mille tre, mille tre. Sempre questa tondadine, cameriere, cittadine, va contesse, baronesse, marchesane, principesse, e non d'ogni, d'ogni grado, d'ogni forma, d'ogni età, d'ogni forma.
Rory Dunn and the catalogue aria from Don Giovanni. Maria Hurley on piano, and Rory and Anna Brady, who you also heard earlier, are the PwC Wexford Festival Opera's winners of the Emerging Young Artists Bursaries. And the production of Falstaff, featuring Anna and Rory and lots of others, will take place online during Wexford Festival Opera. More information from the website wexfordfestivalopera.com. All right, let us move on to the American author William S. Burroughs, a key figure in the Beat movement of the 1940s and 50s. He would go on to become one of the most controversial and influential artists of the 20th century. Burroughs is best known for his experimental novel Naked Lunch, for a wild lifestyle that included accidentally killing his wife Joan, and for his cut-up technique of writing, which involved randomly cutting up and reassembling pieces of paper covered in words technique, famously taken up by David Bowie. Just one of the examples of how Burroughs' influence spread into the music scene in his lifetime. But the book that we're talking about this evening is William Burroughs and the Cult of Rock and Roll, a new book from Washington, D.C. journalist Casey Ray. Peter Murphy has been reading it for us, and he joins me now in the studio. And we'll get to the book in a moment, because it's very interesting that Casey Ray focuses on this connection with music. Transgressive is the word that is kind of next door to William S. Burroughs' name all the time, I think, Peter.
A word that didn't exist when Burroughs was at his most transgressive, ironically enough. But yeah, it's very telling, I think, that one of the great biographies of Burroughs by Ted Morgan was called Literary Outlaw. And he is your classic kind of study in outsider artist or punk avatar or avant-garde adventure, whatever you want to call it, and that he came from middle-class background. His grandfather, William Seward Burroughs, invented a calculating machine that made the family a fortune. And Burroughs in his entire lifetime, pretty much, or certainly into middle age, lived on a stipend provided by the family, which allowed him to embark upon these many and varied adventures, whether it was searching for yahe in the jungles of the Amazon and embarking upon these psychotropic adventures, hanging out in New York City with Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg and everybody that was to become the Beat generation, smoking pot, embarking on harebrained schemes, drinking a lot, and infamously becoming a heroin addict in Mexico and on the border around there, which provided the subject matter for his very first book, Junkie, published by Olympia Press.
Let's listen to what Burroughs said about heroin addiction, and some, I would have thought, dangerous lines within this, but you might expound upon it a little bit afterwards, Peter.
A writer can profit from things that may be just unpleasant or boring to someone else, because he uses those subsequently as material for writing. And I would say that the experience I had that's described in Junkie later led to my subsequent books like Naked Lunch. So I don't regret it. Incidentally, the damage to health is minimal, no matter what the American Narcotics Department may say. The damage to health from addiction is minimal.
It's very difficult to take that, Peter Murphy, from Burroughs, isn't it? The damage to health from heroin, from addiction, is minimal.
Burroughs, to many, is almost like your bad conscience. He's like a satanic figure. He's a very dark and lonely figure. And we can survey his life. And, okay, so he famously accidentally shot his wife, Joan Vollmer, in a drunken William Tell routine. And there's been, you know, decades of speculation as to whether it was some sort of suicidal ideation on her part or some sort of homicidal ideation on his part. His son, Billy, had a short but tragic life and a fine writer himself, but died of alcohol-related afflictions at the age of 30, I think, or 33 in the early 1980s. Darkness follows Burroughs around every step of the way. And I think one of the residual tragedies, very much in the same way as Keith Richards was glamorized for his drug use, is people emulated him and people didn't have his constitution or his drug connections, and they died like flies. People died around those people like flies.
But he's interesting on the idea of control.
Addiction is one of his great themes, the idea, the twin ideas of addiction and control. And in some ways, reading this book, and Casey Ray is very good on this, there's a way of looking at the 21st century as if it's a product of Burroughs's most paranoid writings and imaginings. He would have pioneered ideas like language as a virus. Quite literally as a virus. He foresaw the weaponizing of untruth or mistruth or language or memes.
He was talking about fake news before we had fake news.
Way before, and
had the term.
He was particularly good on a sort of P.T. Barnum huckster figure like Donald Trump. And the idea of the infantilization of an entire society, the benefit of a small, rich elite, and these systems of and his constant recurring theme was addiction and control. And if you think of, you know, the use of social media and substitute the tiny pinprick dopamine hits that you get off a like or a share online at the behest of some sort of shadowy corporate behemoth, and you've got a Burroughsian universe that we currently inhabit.
A type of addiction, it would have to be, it could be argued. Let's listen to him now, because what he said about the heroin, I found it disturbing just having, even listening to it. But anyway, you've given us a thinking behind it there. He's much more likable in this clip where he's speaking about writing. And there's not quite the same sense of ego present in what he says here.
There is only one thing a writer can write about. What is in front of his senses at the moment of writing. I am a recording instrument. I do not presume to impose story, plot, continuity. Insofar as I succeed in direct recording of certain areas of psychic process, I may have limited function.
There you go, William Burroughs. There he is in his Yeatsian mode. He kind of is talking almost about automatic writing. He's just a vessel for this material.
Well, there's an element of Burroughs that's almost like a cross between a stand-up comedian and sort of Roosevelt's fireside homilies and a Mark Twain kind of. He's a very old, very traditional kind of American figure, which is some aged, decrepit character telling you a truth that you don't want to hear through the medium of the radio or the fireside. If anyone is interested, look up Thanksgiving Prayer 1986, filmed by Gus Van Sant, produced by Hal Woolner, which is maybe his greatest kind of tragicomic spiel that I think it premiered on Saturday Night Live early on. He gave it a semi-legendary reading on Saturday Night Live. One of the reasons that Burroughs is so popular with rock musicians was he was an amazing performer himself. He could upstage any rock band with his particular phrasing. So, and you can dip into Naked Lunch at any point. It becomes a bit hairy to withstand 50 pages of Naked Lunch at any given time. But you dip into a Dr. Benway routine where he's massaging some patient's heart with a toilet plunger, and it is stand-up comedy. For 3 pages, it's the greatest thing you've ever read. And at 9 pages, it's the worst.
It's a nightmare. Yeah. Now, this book that we're talking about, William S. Burroughs and the Cult of Rock and Roll. This connection with music hasn't been directly written about before Casey Ray's book.
No, it's always been alluded to, or it's always been threaded through the biographies, and he's had his share of great biographers: Barry Miles, Victor Bockris, Ted Morgan. And there's an enormous amount of stuff online, an enormous amount of documentation, and really interesting. So let's do it. Like, we don't have a lot of time, so let's just do like a family tree in 90 seconds. It begins with like Dylan, who was obsessed with the Beats, who something like Tarantula, his experimental novel, would have been extremely influenced by Burroughs. Then you have the Beatles, who basically ran around after little Bobby Dylan like puppies. So they would have inherited his interest and all the sort of cut up Revolution Number 9 sound collages that were on the White Album. Would have come from Burroughs. Burroughs appeared on the cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Then you go on to Brian Jones, who ended up going to Marrakesh or Morocco to record the Master Musicians of Djibouti, who were made popular by Brian Gyson and Burroughs when Burroughs was living there. You have Lou Reed, the Velvet Underground, were explicitly influenced by Burroughs. Lou Reed once told me that he brings Naked Lunch on holiday with him every time he goes on holiday. In terms of what they could write about, there would have been no Velvet Underground's Heroine without Burroughs. Iggy Pop then followed on. You've got Bowie, who refers
directly to the cut-up techniques, cutting things up and putting them down and see what comes out.
And as he got later and later into his career, even all the way up to Earthling and Outside, was using computers to randomly cut up and regenerate text. And Burroughs, basically, if you read Wild Boys and you read Clockwork Orange, they're basically the template for punk rock. Then you get into post-punk, the sort of gloomy industrial stuff like Joy Division and Throbbing Gristle. Kurt Cobain on In Utero was influenced by the cut-up and collaborated with Burroughs on The Priest, They Call Him. U2, Tom Waits.
It goes on.
It goes on and on.
You loved this Casey Ray book and you think it's well worth reading.
I think he did a really good job of actually getting out of the way of the material, because the material is so rich. It's a very disciplined and accessible. If you've heard of Burroughs and you're looking for a way in, this is probably the most accessible way. Rather than reading a literary biography, this is as good a way in as any.
All right, that's William Burroughs and The Cult of Rock and Roll. Peter Murphy speaking to us about it this evening. It's published by White Rabbit and brings us to the end of Thursday night's programme. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Dave Gibson was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock.